On our vacation this year, our wandering feet took us to Morocco, to Spain, and Majorca. Places, with the exception of Spain, that we had not been before. We were in search of sun and rest, and we found both and much interest besides. Morocco, you may recall, is at the northwest tip of Africa. It was from here that the Moors, long ago, crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and invaded Spain. It is today an independent monarchy, having achieved its independence 6 years ago, for until 1956, it was a protectorate of France and Spain, with Tangier as an international zone. Morocco has a population of about 8 million, nearly all Mohammedans, nearly all illiterate. It is an agricultural and pastoral land with little industry, rather rich in mineral deposits, little of which, however, has as yet been exploited. Our own government, the United States government, has built in Morocco a few military air bases at very great cost, from which it has now been invited to withdraw. We spent 3 weeks in Morocco, visiting its principal cities of Casablanca, Rabat, its capital, Saleh, Marrakech, Fez, Tangier. And being a rabbi, and therefore on a busman's holiday, I was especially interested in the Jewish communities of Morocco and in their history. There are some 160,000 Jews living today in Morocco. There have been, until recently, some 350,000. Nearly 200,000 have left for other countries. France, South America, Canada, and especially Israel. And many more Moroccan Jews want to leave. Jews have lived in Morocco since before the Common Era, before it even became a Roman province and was known as Mauritania or Barbary. Following the failure of the two revolutions against Rome in 70 and 135 of the Common Era, many Jews from Palestine migrated to other lands. And by the 4th century, we know that Jews were to be found everywhere in North Africa, from Egypt to Morocco. We have records, reliable records, that some of the native tribes of Morocco, known as the Berbers, from which the name Barbary comes from, that some of these Berber tribes were converted to Judaism. Many Berber tribes still bear unmistakable traces of their Jewish origin, both in their physiognomy and in their customs. In the 7th century, the Arabs invaded Morocco in their imperial sweep across North Africa. And they encountered the resistance of these Berber tribes, many of whom professed Judaism. It is recorded that a Berber Jewess by the name of Dalia led them into battle. Now, these original Jewish settlers of the early centuries, plus these Berber converts, were joined from time to time in later centuries by Jews who fled from the Visigothic persecutions in Spain in the centuries before the Muslim conquest, and especially because of the persecutions during the reign of the Visigothic king Sisebut, who in 612 ordered all Jews to leave Spain unless they consented to baptism. And of course, many Jews fled, and many of them fled to Morocco. Now, by and large, the Jews got along pretty well with their Arab rulers in Morocco. They had, of course, to pay the required tribute of all non-Muslims. They resided in separate quarters in the cities, which were known as the mellahs, though they were not forced to live exclusively in these mellahs. And they engaged in agriculture and trade and commerce, and some of them held important posts in government. And they built synagogues and rabbinic academies, yeshivot, and carried on a lively correspondence with the great rabbinic schools in Babylonia, Sura, and Pumbedita, which had become the great religious centers of world Jewry. In the 10th and 11th centuries, Morocco Jewry produced scholars of note, such as the foremost Talmudist and rabbinic codifier of his day, Isaac Alfasi, that is, Isaac of the city of Fez, and the pioneer Hebrew grammarians and philologists like Dunash Ibn Labrat and Joseph Hayun. Moses Maimonides lived in Fez for 5 years before he finally settled in Egypt. And our Jewish guides took great pride to point out to us the place where he had lived. Morocco, be it remembered, was one of the important centers of Jewish life in the early Middle Ages. Now, a disastrous change in the fortunes of Moroccan Jews came in the middle of the 12th century when the ultra-Orthodox, bigoted, and fanatical Moorish dynasty of the Almohads came to power. And these Almohads subjugated not only the whole of Morocco, but southern Spain as well. They gave both Jews and Christians the desperate choice of embracing Islam or leaving the country. And many Jews fled from Morocco to Egypt, to other parts of North Africa. Others embraced Islam, though they still lived as Jews in secret. And these Jews newly converted to Islam were nevertheless compelled to wear a special costume with a yellow cloth for a head covering, which was the prototype of the Jew badge of later times in Christian lands. Now, when the power of these Almohads was finally broken by another dynasty. In the 13th century, the position of the Jews who returned to Morocco, or who in later centuries migrated there in large numbers, again from Spain, because of the terrible persecution of the Jews in Spain in 1391, and again as a result of the frightful expulsion from Spain in 1492 and from Portugal in 1497. I say the position of the Jews in later times after the Almohads did not improve to any degree. Moroccan Jewry never recovered from the crushing blows of the Almohads, and a pattern of persecution and degradation for centuries to come set in. Under succeeding dynasties, their position remained subject to the whim of the rulers, to their demands and extortions, and subject also to the scorn and contempt of the populace. They were reduced to the most menial occupations and were forced to live exclusively in these mellahs. And frequently they were attacked and robbed and massacred. From the 18th century, we're coming closer to our own time. From the 18th century, the following account reaches us about the position of the Jews of Morocco. The Jews possessed neither lands nor gardens, nor can they enjoy their fruits in tranquility. They must wear only black and are obliged, when they pass near mosques or through streets in which there are mosque sanctuaries, to walk barefoot. The lowest among the Moors imagines he has a right to ill-treat a Jew, nor dares the latter to defend himself. And this condition, with only slight amendment here and there, continued throughout the 17th, the 18th, and the 19th century. As a result of these cruel persecutions and their degraded political and economic status, the intellectual life of the Jews of Morocco stagnated. Their level of education sank very low. Superstition was and continues to be rife among them. Belief in charms and amulets and saints is widespread. The Arabs of Morocco worship saints at their tombs, or marabouts as they are called, which dot the countryside of Morocco. Now there are several similar shrines or sacred tombs to which the Jews of Morocco make pilgrimages. We visited one of them, the tomb of a saint named Samuel Hanes. And from all parts of Morocco, Jews come to pray at this tomb of Samuel Hanes and to kindle tapers. There is a very famous shrine at Kaysan, the tomb of a miracle worker, Abraham Moniz, which is visited on his special anniversary, which is called the Hilula, by some 10,000 pilgrims, including some Mohammedans. The Moroccan Jews are among the most zealous of the followers of the false messiah Shabbatai Tzvi in the 17th century. In fact, they produced a pseudo-messiah of their own in the wake of this Sabbatean movement. One Joseph Ben Sur in the city of Meknes. Now the synagogues of the Moroccan Jews, quite a number of which we visited, their synagogues today are as a rule very small, no larger than a classroom, poor, tucked away somewhere in the narrow alleys of the mellahs, neglected looking. In many instances, they are private homes which have been fitted out for worship. The walls are covered with Kabbalistic prayers and symbols, and from the low ceilings are suspended these dimly lit, age-encrusted oil lamps. And on any day of the week, you will find some aged Jews sitting there, huddled and swaying and chanting psalms in unison. An attempt was made in the middle of the 19th century to improve the position of the Jews of Morocco. In 1883, Sir Moses Montefiore, supported by the British government, went to Morocco and asked, rather demanded of the Sultan, that the Jews there should be protected, that no person should molest them, and that they should enjoy the same privileges as all other subjects. Montefiore was successful. In 1884, an edict was published granting equal rights to the Jews. But the local magistrates, in most instances, ignored these edicts and similar ones which followed them. And the condition remained pretty much the same. A definite improvement took place when the French occupied Morocco in 1912. The Jews were confirmed in their full civil rights, and the French remained in control of Morocco, as you may recall, some 50 years. But 6 years ago, the French withdrew, and Morocco was again a sovereign Muslim state, and the Jews are again experiencing certain political pressures. The rising nationalism among the Muslim population and the efforts of the government to Arabize all things, including all Jewish schools, have added to their sense of insecurity. Emigration, especially to Israel, is prohibited, though not always enforced. Now, the economic condition of the Jews of Morocco, except for a very small, well-to-do upper class, and there is a small, well-to-do upper class and some few very rich Jews in Morocco, but their economic conditions generally are appalling. There is a frightening contrast in that country, as I suppose elsewhere, in similar lands along the Mediterranean, or like in our Latin America. There is a frightening contrast between the rich and the poor, between that thin upper stratum of well-to-do and that vast mass living in poverty, unspeakable, unimaginable. The majority of the Jews of Morocco live in squalor and are engaged in the humblest of occupations. Many of them have no occupations at all, but live on begging, charity. It is pathetic to visit the Jewish marketplaces as we visited them, and the stalls of Jewish merchants, so to speak, in the narrow, winding alleys of the mellahs of Casablanca and Marrakesh, fairs elsewhere, and see the inventory, the small stock and trade of these so-called merchants. A handful of asparagus, a dozen eggs, a tray of salt and pepper, a few oranges, a bag full of figs and dates, or some second-hand clothes, while the merchants themselves are dressed in rags. About 100 years ago, the Alliance Israelite Universelle was founded by French Jews to protect the political rights and to furnish educational opportunities to backward Jewish communities in the world. And the Alliance interested itself especially in the Jews of Morocco. It founded the first school for Jewish children in 1862. That is a modern school. There were little chadarim, little religious schools that existed all through the ages. But in 1862, the Alliance founded the first school for Jewish children. And since then, it has established 75 such schools where some 30,000 Jewish children receive a secular as well as a Jewish education, an education which would otherwise have been denied to them. And other Jewish organizations have established schools for Jewish boys and girls, such as the Otzar HaTorah, an organization devoted to the promotion of religious and secular education in the Middle East and North Africa, and more recently, the Lubavitcher Schools, a Hasidic sect whose headquarters are in Brooklyn. The Lubavitcher Hasidim have established certain schools, certain good schools in Morocco. Over 20 modern kindergartens, expertly supervised and attended by nearly 4,000 children, are in operation. If you would know what it means to pull out a child in Morocco from the dirt and the squalor of the hovel in which his parents live and bring him to a sunshiny, clean, modern kindergarten with supervised play and all the attendant things, you'd realize what a life-saving thing this is. There is an organization known as the OZE, a health service, which has established clinics and dispensaries and is carrying on remarkable health programs in Moroccan children as well as adults. It is bringing to these people, among whom disease, you can readily understand, is prevalent and epidemics frequent, it is bringing to them health and new concepts of hygiene, cleanliness, and nutrition. The ORT, an organization, as you well know, for the rehabilitation through the training of youth in useful trades and occupations. The ORT has some very fine schools in Morocco and has some 4,000 young people enrolled in its courses. Now, all of these vital institutions, which constitute, in my humble judgment, the one bright spot in the otherwise very dark and somber picture. These vital institutions, many of whom we visited and had a chance to observe their programs, all of them are supported by the American Joint Distribution Committee. That is to say, by the generosity of American Jews, by the contribution that you yourselves make annually to the United Jewish Appeal. It's one thing to give to these funds anonymously, to a fund, United Jewish Appeal. It's quite a different thing to see what is being done with that money, with your own eyes. Every Jewish child in Morocco, except those who come from self-sustaining homes, receives in these schools, whether it's the ORT, the Otzar HaTorah, the Lubavitcher, or the Alliance, receives in these schools breakfast, a hot meal at noon, carefully planned by dietitians, and a snack in the afternoon before they return home. I was amazed when I was told that the total cost for food per child per month is $1.60. A whole A whole generation of Moroccan children is thus being saved from hunger and ignorance and hopelessness by fellow Jews in other lands who care. You have not forgotten the ancient Jewish code. Call Yisrael, Arevim, Zelazeh. All Jews are responsible one for another. Now many of the young Jews are leaving Morocco. They do not believe that there is any future for them there. And many of the businessmen have left or would like to leave. I spoke to quite a number of them. No future. The poor and the aged, too, would like to go. Most Moroccan Jews would like to go to Israel. Morocco is today a member of the Arab League. And that, the Jews suspect, does not bode well for them. When Colonel Nasser recently visited King Hassan II of Morocco, there were riots against the Jews. Now from Tangier in Morocco, which is, by the way, no longer a free port, Tangier, and is therefore declining economically, from Tangier we flew to Madrid, the capital of Spain. We've been there before, some 5 years ago. There is much to regale the eye of the tourist in this very modern and very attractive city of Madrid, which compares favorably with the impressive capitals of Europe. And here again, as a rabbi, I was particularly interested in the Jewish life of the city. There's very little of it, but more than there was 5 years ago. The Jewish community has grown. It now numbers some 500 to 600 souls. There was a time, and that not so long ago, when there were no Jews in Madrid. Since the expulsion in 1492, there remained no Jews in the whole of Spain. Except, of course, the crypto-Jews, or the Moranios, as they were called, who in the course of time and under the pressure of the Inquisition were completely absorbed in the population and disappeared as Jews. And while there was never in recent times or before any official cherem, that is a ban, against Jews returning to Spain, Jews nevertheless throughout the centuries avoided Spain. In the early part of this century, there was only an insignificant number of Jews in that country and no organized Jewish community. Early in the 20th century, the Spanish government adopted a more friendly and welcoming attitude towards the return of Jews to Spain. A Jew, Professor Abraham Yehuda, Orientalist and biblical scholar, was appointed to a chair of Hebrew studies in the University of Madrid. An organization called the Union Hispano-Hebrea, composed of prominent Spaniards and Jews, was founded, whose aim was to foster friendly relations between Spaniards and Sephardim everywhere, that is, Jews whose ancestors had been expelled from Spain in 1492. And the king, King Alfonso XIII, the last king of Spain, accepted the honorary presidency of this organization. And Sephardim everywhere were now sort of wooed. The Sephardim along the shores of the Mediterranean were now referred to as the lost sons of Spain. And a special law was published which facilitated the obtaining of Spanish citizenship by Sephardi Jews outside of Spain. And Jews felt themselves particularly comfortable under the Spanish Republic, which was established, you may recall, in 1930. And this government issued an official statement declaring that the expulsion edict of 1492 was null and void. And in 1935, the Spanish government officially celebrated the 1,000th anniversary of the birth of Moses Maimonides. A public service was held in Cordova, the birthplace of Maimonides, the first public service since the expulsion. And special commemorative stamps to mark this occasion were issued by the government. When the Republic was overthrown in the Spanish Civil War by Franco, the Jewish community of Spain again disintegrated. Franco was under Nazi influence. Sharp measures were taken against the Jews, and as many of them as could again fled. And those refugees who escaped into Spain from Vichy France, you remember, during the Second World War, were interned in jails or camps. Now, in more recent years, and this is interesting, with the defeat of the Nazis, a friendlier attitude has been manifested by the government towards Jews and Judaism. Catholic Church leaders have taken steps to improve relations between Jews and non-Jews. An organization called Amistad Judeo Cristiana was founded in Madrid, very much like our Conference of Christians and Jews, which meets regularly, and its meetings are attended by Christians and Jews, at which ways towards better understanding and cooperation are explored. The tolerant attitude of the new Pope, Pope John, has undoubtedly been helpful in this regard, especially in Spain, which is the most Catholic country in the world. Pope John, you may recall, in 1960, just a year or two ago, declared, "True, there is a great difference between one who accepts only the Old Testament and one who joins to it as supreme law and guide the new. This distinction, however, does not suppress the brotherhood that springs from their common origin, for we are all sons of the same Heavenly Father, and among us all there must ever be the brightness of love and its practice." If only some other popes had spoken that way in the Middle Ages, not so very, very long ago, how different Jewish history would have been. We visited the synagogue of Madrid, which is called Beth Zion. It is on the second floor of a large office building. It carries no sign on the outside of the building for no church other than the Catholic Church. No church, that holds true of Protestant churches as well, is permitted to display its identity on the outside of its building. This synagogue is not very large, but is attractive. On Sabbaths and holidays, we are told, it is crowded with worshippers. They're planning to build a larger edifice soon. And in the corridor of this synagogue, we saw large cases of matzahs, which had already arrived from London in anticipation of Passover. They have as yet no rabbi, and each month a shochet is brought in from Morocco, and kosher meat is kept in deep freeze. The president of the Jewish community of Madrid, with whom we dined, was very encouraged by the friendly attitude of the government and very sanguine about the steady return of Jews to Spain, even under the ruthless dictatorship of Franco. Regarded as significant as a significant event in Jewish history. Well, hope springs eternal in the Jewish breast. And from Madrid, we flew to Majorca. George Sand, who had a tryst with Chopin in Majorca and wrote, you may recall, Winter in Majorca, said of the island, "In Majorca alone I finally saw the sea of my dream, clear and blue as the sky." And Chopin, who composed some of his loveliest preludes there at Valdemosa in a Carthusian monastery from which the monks had been expelled by the revolution, Chopin called it the loveliest spot on earth. The ancients called it the Golden Isle. It is fast becoming a popular tourist resort, especially Palma, its principal city. I'm saying all this not by way of a commercial. But here too, you walk historic ground. And here too, there is much submerged Jewish history. It's amazing how the rabbi finds Jewish history everywhere. Jews settled in Majorca in Roman times. From the 5th century, we have records of Jewish persecutions already in Majorca at the hands of some intolerant bishops. In the 8th century, Majorca was conquered by the Moors. It was during the great century of conquest when they swept all over the countries of the Mediterranean. And the Moors remained in possession of Majorca for 400 years. You can still hear the music of the Moors and the singing of the Majorcans. Jews prospered during that time. And from the 12th century, we have records of 3 synagogues which were built in Palma. Early in the 13th century, James I of Aragon conquered Majorca from the Moors, and the island became Christian. The Jews were for a time unmolested, although we do read of a certain bishop of Majorca who imposed a heavy fine upon the Jews and curtailed their privileges because they were accused of having converted 2 Christians to Judaism. The Jewish community nevertheless continued to grow and prosper. In the 14th century, it numbered more than 1,000 families. And it carried on extensive trade with North Africa and the Orient. And it seems to have enjoyed a vigorous intellectual life. The Jews of Majorca were the most famous cartographers of their day, makers of maps. They made the most important maps, which were prized by the great navigators of that period who were setting out on their epochal voyages of discovery and exploration. A Majorcan Jew, Gabriel de Valestra, made a map of the world in 1439, which was used by Amerigo Vespucci, who gave his name to the continents of the Western Hemisphere, to the Americas, just as Christopher Columbus carried with him the astronomical tables of the Spanish Jew Abraham Zacuta on his voyage of discovery of America. "There is strong historic evidence," writes Robert Graves, the author who has lived on Majorca for many years, "There is strong historic evidence for supposing that Christopher Columbus himself, who by the way never signed himself in any other way as Cristobal Colon, was a Majorcan Jew. His surname Colon is still common in the island." Of course, the Spanish Jewish origin of Columbus is now no longer questioned by the historian. Now, the change in the fortune of the Jews in Majorca came after that terrible year, 1391, which was a catastrophic year in Jewish history. Incited by a fanatical clergy, a wave of persecution, terror, and massacre swept over the Jewish communities of Spain, beginning in Seville where the Jewish quarter was mobbed, and those who refused to be baptized were killed or sold as slaves, the terror swept over the whole of the Spanish peninsula. Numerous Jewish communities, prosperous Jewish communities, were destroyed. A large number, a very large number of Jews became Christians in order to save their lives. These new Christians, these conversos, came to be known as Moranos, a very unpleasant title assigned to them. Moranos means swine. And the Jews of Majorca shared a similar fate. In 1391, some 300 Jews were killed by frenzied mobs, 1391 or shortly thereafter, and the rest were forcibly converted. And these converted Jews of Majorca came to be known as Chuetas, probably a corrupted form of Judeos, Jews, although something that also comes from the Majorcan word of pork, swine, pig. They too were looked upon as outcasts. I mean, these converted Jews, even though they were converted. Secretly, some of them continued to practice Judaism, like the Moranos, their counterpart on the mainland of Spain. And to ferret out these neo-Christians who secretly practiced Judaism after their conversion, the Inquisition was established in Spain in 1480 and continued to operate for 300 years. It operated also in Mexico and in some of the islands of the Caribbean. It operated also in Majorca. In 1658, 20 Chuetas were burnt at the stake for practicing Judaism. Their possessions were confiscated by the royal treasury. How many of these Chuetas are left today in Majorca, it is difficult to say. Some estimate their numbers to be some 200 to 300 families, others much higher. Some maintain that nearly all Majorcan tradesmen and businessmen are of Jewish descent. These Chuetas today are, of course, devout Catholics. But nevertheless, they still, to this very day, constitute a distinct social group, a close-knit community, and are concentrated in two of the Palma streets, which we saw, most of them still engaged in their trade as goldsmiths. An interesting thing about these Chuetas. Last May, a Chueta woman from Majorca, whose father was a general in Franco's army, by the name of Isabel de Monmouth, came to Israel and asked to be converted to Judaism. She was converted, and then she returned to Palma as Elisheva Yamin Oz. She was a very wealthy woman. She placed a mezuzah on the door of her apartment and has since been endeavoring to persuade other Chuetas to reconvert to Judaism. This, as you may well imagine, has created something of a sensation, something of a scandal on the island. We visited the beautiful Palma Cathedral. And in this Palma Cathedral, there are two chandeliers hanging from the ceiling, which our Christian guide told us in great pride came originally from an old Jewish synagogue in Palma. This made me feel good. And in the treasury of this same cathedral, they have perfectly marvelous monstrances and the chasubles and the dresses of the priests and the bishops and sacred object, some relics from the cross. In the treasury of this cathedral, I saw two maces, such as are carried in church processions. And the tops of these maces were formed out of old, beautiful rimonim, that is, Torah crowns, on which one could still read the Hebrew inscription. Torat Adonai Tmima, the Torah of the Lord is perfect. Pikudei Adonai Yisharim, the commandments of the Lord are righteous. And in the structure of one of the churches in Parma, not the cathedral, called Mount Zion, Monte Zion Church, there is built in, there is incorporated, part of an old Jewish synagogue which dates from before the conquest of the island by the Spaniards. And so going to Majorca to look for sun and rest, we found a good deal of Jewish history. And so after a few interesting weeks abroad, in places which are today no longer so far away, we returned home, having refreshed ourselves and having refreshed our knowledge of Jewish life and history. And I assure you that we are grateful to be back in a land where Jewish annals are not filled with so many dark shadows of the past, and where life generally is so rich in the blessings of freedom.